Okay. So that up, what we have done up to now is we have tried to understand what privacy is and what it looks like in the world. And what we will look at now is why is privacy important? Why do we want it? What is it for? And this is a subject of much debate. So I think we can go back to ChatGPT and see what ChatGPT says. Why is privacy important? Why is privacy important in AI ethics? Let's see, in 50 words or fewer. In 50 words or fewer. Fewer. Why is privacy important? Why do we want privacy? Why do we want privacy? All right, let's see what ChatGPT says about why we want privacy, what it is good for. It's vital to safeguard individual autonomy, prevent misuse of personal data, ensure trust in technology, protect against discrimination and harmful profiling, and uphold fundamental human rights in an increasingly data-driven world. It's key to maintaining dignity and freedom in the digital age. Okay, typical bad ChatGPT, right? They define privacy, why it's important, by just a slew of other words that are difficult to understand, like it's key to maintaining dignity and freedom, right? So you see how the ideas that we are thinking about, how naturally they link. We've talked about autonomy or freedom and dignity, and now we're talking about privacy. And it's true that triangle of ideas are closely related. And it's probably true what ChatGPT is saying, that maintaining one is also about maintaining the other two. But it doesn't tell us anything about why in our real everyday lives we want privacy. It says also we want privacy to protect against discrimination and harmful profiling. I think in that case, this is one of those cases where ChatGPT is 180 degrees wrong. To protect against discrimination and harmful profiling, we need to violate privacy, right? Because let's just say in the case of hiring, let's say that we are worried about a company that discriminates unjustly when they are hiring against tall people, against people who are taller than 6 feet tall. Let's say the owner of the company hates tall people, and so the owner tries to avoid hiring people who are tall. The only way that you could identify and determine whether or not this, which seems like unfair discrimination, whether or not this unfair discrimination is happening, is by getting the personal information of the applicants, right? I mean, you need to violate their privacy. You need to find out how tall every applicant is, in order to determine and see, oh, look, somehow, even though this person is hiring thousands of people every year, somehow they never hire someone who is taller than 6 feet. So in fact, ChatGPT is 180 degrees wrong here. Privacy is not necessary to protect against discrimination and harmful profiling. It's the opposite. In order to protect against discrimination, we need to have less privacy. We need to eliminate privacy, at least in the area that we're interested in. We need to find out, in the case of height, how tall all the applicants are. And we need to find out whether or not we have consent from those applicants, right? That is, I mean, if we're going to be, of course, the way you would normally do it in the world is you would just ask them to give consent and see if you could get consent from everybody and then find out. But in a pure theoretical case, if you are going to guarantee that you don't have discrimination against tall people, then you must, whether or not the applicants give you consent, you must find out what their height is. Otherwise, you can't tell. Now, of course, this is just a toy case. It doesn't make very much difference, but that difference, right, that conflict is true no matter what you are interested in, whether it's height or weight or gender or religion or anything else. If you want to prevent discrimination, then you must, again, theoretically, violate privacy. But you've got to take people's personal information. Otherwise, you don't know whether or not the discrimination exists. So anyway, so the point there is that ChatGPT is wrong on that one. So be careful with ChatGPT. Now, we can give better right answers. Why do we want privacy? There are two fundamental reasons. We want privacy to be someone, and we want privacy to be someone else. And when I say someone else, I mean we want privacy in order to change who we ourselves are, in order to explore new ways of experiencing the world, new ways of existing in the world, new ways of acting, new kinds of jobs, new interests, and so on. I mean, all these kinds of changes that people have in their lives, whether it's going to live in a different country or trying a different career path or so on, these are all changes not just in where we happen to live or what our job is. These are also changes in who we are. To a certain extent, we define our own work, but our work defines us. We define where we live, but where we live also defines us. So when I say to be someone else, we want privacy in order to be someone else in that sense, to be someone different. But before that, I want to say that we want privacy to be someone. Just to be someone, just to be who we are, we need privacy. And here's what I mean. I mean two things. One, first, there is kind of a chilling effect. I mean, imagine that right now, and I have this camera on, imagine that this camera was a live stream camera for, you know, on YouTube, and it's in, let's say we're going to put it in my living room, and it's going to be on 24 hours a day, and I can't turn it off. Well, obviously, when I'm in my living room then, and I know that anyone in the world can be watching me, I am not going to do something like the example I used before, let's say, just invented that I like to sing ABBA in the shower. Well, I'm certainly not going to sing ABBA songs in the living room if I'm afraid that people will be watching me on YouTube on this live broadcast. But maybe I really like singing ABBA songs. Maybe that's part of who I am. Or maybe, right, I'm thinking that someday I could form a musical band that plays ABBA songs and I'm practicing or something. Who knows? The important point is that we all know that when we are being watched by anyone at any time, we tend to act in ways which are naturally, and for good reason, we tend to act in ways which are very restricted. We don't exhibit sides of ourselves which are more individual. We try to act, we act formally, right? We talk the way people are supposed to talk in social situations. We use good manners. We say hello and goodbye and nice to meet you and so on. All kinds of things we don't do when we're in more personal settings. Like when the family members come back to the house, I don't say, hello, nice to see you again. Right? We say, what's up? What's going on? How was your day? That kind of thing. But if there was a camera watching, right, then of course we're going to change the way we interact with the people around us. So we want privacy. We want control over who can see our interactions and just see into our lives so that, or in order to be who we are. Otherwise, if everyone is watching us all the time, then we're going to be this kind of neutral person, right, who doesn't exhibit any special actions or language or interests and so on that depart from the normal. So that's kind of the practical reason why we want privacy. I mean, all you need to do is just imagine, right, that you're being filmed all the time and it's being shown on YouTube all the time. Well, you're always going to dress very conservatively and act very conservatively, and you'll never really be yourself. You'll always be just kind of this formal person acting for the camera in a way that doesn't embarrass you and so on. That just seems clear and obvious, right? I mean, if you don't have privacy, if you don't have some limit upon who can see what you're doing and when and how and why, then you're going to act in ways which are not like you. You're going to act in ways which are just neutral, just could be anyone. Right? So just on the practical level, in order to be someone, in order to have a personality, in order to be different, from the person who lives next door and to like different music and to dress in different ways and to act in different ways and so on. You really need to have some limit, be able to put some limit on who witnesses the way you are acting, who witnesses what you are wearing, who witnesses what you are saying, and so on. So privacy is necessary in order to be some one person, as opposed to just this kind of neutral X, right, who could be anyone. And of course, in public settings, that's the way we act, and that's fine. But in order to be someone, right, we need a private setting. So that's the practical way of thinking about this. And then theoretically, the way that we present ourselves as someone is precisely by revealing the information, personally identifying information, like you see in this picture. Okay, so there's a reason for this picture, which I'm going to show you in the next slide. I didn't just choose this picture for no reason, but this person obviously is revealing something about their personality when they hold up wine and beer and seem very happy about drinking both at the same time. That's a fun-loving, partying woman, which is great, right? But she probably would not, in order for her to present that image of herself happy, and some people looking at this picture, I guess think of it this way. Some people looking at this picture are going to say, oh, that's a great woman, right? I would love to meet her. She'd be a great person to meet and have fun with and go to a bar with and so on. Whereas other people would say, I don't like the kind of woman who drinks that much, and really it's not very fun because I have a headache the next morning and da da da, right? So she is really doing a very good job here of defining herself as someone, right? And when you do that, what happens? When you define yourself as someone, some people will like it, some people won't. I mean, that's how you know you're someone, right? If everyone likes what you're doing, or everyone is neutral about what you're doing, then you're not anybody. Right? When you are someone, some people like it and some people don't, right? And doing that, being someone is revealing information about yourself, right? She's revealing this personal side of herself, which is that she likes to drink. Which again, is great. We're not talking about whether drinking is good or bad. It doesn't matter. What we're talking about is the fact that she's revealing information about herself, personal information, and that's what gives her the identity, right? It's not that you have an identity and then you reveal the information about yourself that you like to drink. It's because you are revealing the information that you like to drink that you have the identity. That's the way you make your identity. It's the way you shape yourself as being someone, by revealing personally identifying information. Right? That happens on all kinds of levels. It happens on a very shallow level when I say that I'm 6'3". That is some personal identifying information. It probably does tell you a little bit about what it means to be me. But this picture tells you a lot more, right? You know a lot more about her than you know about me, at least if you just know that I'm tall. Because this, you know a lot about her from the way that picture is. So personal identifying information, I really want to stress that point. It's not that you are someone, right? And therefore you show this picture of you drinking double fisting. It's that because you're double fisting, that's why you are someone. Right? It's the revealing of that personal information that makes you who you are as someone who's different from all the other women out there and all the other men and everyone else is out there. That's the way you do it. That's the way you make yourself someone. So there's this theoretical, and again, here we're kind of drifting toward the philosophy of things. But there's this kind of theoretical idea that the reason we want privacy, the reason we need privacy, is to be someone. If there was no privacy, we could not be a particular individual different from other individuals around us. Or at least we could not, maybe we could be because they could paint a number on us or something. But we could not control, right? That's the important point. We could not control the fact that we are different in certain ways from other people around us. Privacy is the way that we control how we are individuals in the world, how we are like her, as opposed to like all the other women or men in the world. Okay. So privacy is the first reason why privacy is important is because it is the way we are someone, the way we are an individual in the world. It's the way we are someone instead of just a neutral nothing. And then now, so I promised you I would tell you, this image was not just selected because I like double fisting. It was instead selected because this is actually a famous image in the world of privacy. It belongs to a young woman who probably no longer young. This is from 20 or 30 years ago. Ashley Payne was a teacher in a elementary school. This is way back when Facebook was just starting. And she went on vacation and did the kinds of things a lot of young people do on vacation. She drank beer and wine and God knows what else at the same time. Someone took a picture. That happens too all the time. It used to be people would take a Polaroid or something and then the picture would just circulate amongst a few people. But now with Facebook and digital photography, someone took a picture. They put it on the Facebook page. Technically, the page was listed as private, but Facebook back then, and maybe it's still true now to a certain extent, that really didn't mean anything. And somehow this picture, which I'm not sure if it was on her page or on one of her friends' page, whatever, it somehow circulated out and ended up in the accounts of students and parents of students in the elementary school where she was teaching. For that reason, the elementary school decided to fire her from her job. Now, I think today we've sort of become more used to the idea that, unfortunately, since everything is photographed, people are going to get caught doing things which are not, which presents them in ways which are not the ways they want to be presented. Of course, no teacher wants to be presented in this way, double fisting. No teacher wants to have that image associated with who they are when they are teaching. Right? Imagine if I'm teaching this class and you had behind me playing on the instead of this slide, right? You had me behind me playing a video of me slamming beers at a bar or something. Well, I mean, you wouldn't take me seriously as a professor. Now, of course, all of you know. Theoretically, or not theoretically, all of you know implicitly in your mind that probably Brousseau, once in a while, he drinks a beer or a wine, and maybe he even actually has both at the same time or sequentially or something. All of you know that's true or suspect probably it's true. Most people drink beer and wine. But there's a difference, right, between kind of knowing that's true and having a picture of it. So, when this picture circulated, the school decided to fire her because they thought it gave an unprofessional image to their teachers. Now, as I say, the rules have changed since then, but this was just back at the start of Facebook. And so it was really shocking for people to see and to know that, look, students are sitting in the class, and just when they go home, they can look on their computers and see pictures of their teacher like that. It seemed to run counter to the... Well, it didn't seem to. It does. It does run counter to the image that the teacher wants to give to be successful in the classroom. I mean, you can't be, like I said, imagine a video behind of me just slamming beers. I can't be successful as a professor if you're just watching me slam beers all the time. Something similar was going on here, right? That the parents said and the school said, look, she can't be a successful teacher anymore. Because all the students will think when they see her teaching is this woman double fisting. So she was fired. Now the reason I'm showing you this is first, I think it shows you a little bit how like the rules of internet and images and privacy, how culturally determinative they are. Today we would not think of firing a teacher for doing this, but back then it made perfect sense. Almost everyone agreed, look, the professor has lost. Or the teacher has lost her sort of dignity as a teacher, and she can't be successful in the classroom, so she has to go. But the point I'm trying to make specifically with this slide is that this is personal information that she had. It showed who she was, right? And in order to be someone, right? In this case, not the drinker, but in order to be a teacher, in order to be successful as a teacher in a classroom, which depends upon hopefully you not being, I think not hopefully, it does depend upon you not being drunk, right? In order to be successful as a teacher, right, she has to be able to project in the classroom an image of her as a sober and thoughtful and serious person. She cannot be successful in the classroom if what she is projecting is the image of crazy drinking. Now, as I say, of course, we understand that today we can have both things at once. But back then, and when all this was new, right, this image just ruined the idea people had of her as a teacher. And what that emphasizes, or what it shows, is how important it is, it was then and it still is now, to control access over your personal information in order to be someone. Right? In order to be a teacher, successful teacher, she had to suppress that information. And that's still true today, right? Maybe exactly how much it needs to be suppressed is different. But like I say, if there was a video going behind me right now, right up there, right, of me just hammering beers and wine and stuff, I mean, you would not take me seriously in this class. And you would be right to not take me seriously. So for you to take me seriously as a professor, one thing I need to do is I need to ruthlessly, to some extent, significant extent, control access to my personally identifying information. I have to hide from you the fact that I drink beers, right, with dinner, wine with dinner, and so on. Or sometimes I drink wine and beers too much, just double fisting, who knows, right? The specifics don't matter. What matters is that for me to be a professor, I need to show you things about me, but I also need to hide things about me. And just use your imagination, right? And what do I need to hide from you? Well, I need to hide from you scenes that you might be able to video of me drinking. There are other scenes that you could video of me doing other things, which would probably be even worse, which would be even more distracting, so on. So for me to be a professor, and for her to be a teacher, and for you to be anyone, whether you're going to be a lawyer or an accountant or an insurance salesman or what have you, you need to do two things. You need to, and both, you need to do one thing, which is control access to your personal information. And that has two components. One component is you show a certain side of yourself, but the other component is you hide a lot of yourself. You can only be successful as a teacher or anything else by both showing part of who you are and by hiding part of who you are. And that's what the Ashley Payne case shows. For her to be successful as a teacher, she has to hide this other part of her personality, which is the crazy double-fisting drinker. And because she failed to do that, she lost her job. Now, we could debate about whether that was the right or wrong decision then, and we could debate about how the standards have changed over time. All that is fine. But what stays the same throughout is this idea that privacy is important, among other reasons, because it allows us to be who we are. It allows me to be a professor. And it allows that because what I'm doing when I'm a professor now is I am showing you part of my personal identifying information that has to do with the education I have received, the kind of knowledge that I think is important and other things. I'm showing you that part of myself, but I'm hiding a lot of other parts of myself. I'm not telling you what I happen to like for lunch. I'm not telling you or showing you what I drink, and there's all kinds of, and I'm not showing you how I take my showers, right? And all that stuff. All that stuff is being hidden. And that's the way I become a professor, both by showing you part of me and by hiding you part of me, which means that privacy is the way I am someone. That's why privacy is important, because it's what lets me be me. It's what let Ashley Payne be a teacher and then not be a teacher because she lost privacy. It's what lets you be whatever you want to be, right? With your family, you're one person. With your friends, you're someone else. With at your job, you're someone else. It's privacy that allows that. Okay, so that's the first part of privacy. this idea that we want primacy because it allows us to be someone and not other people. It allows us to be the teacher and not the double-fisting drinker. That's one idea. The other idea is that we want privacy because privacy allows us to become someone else. And this is really one of my favorite cases. This is a case from an academic paper where a young woman who's also, I believe it's a woman, I'm not sure, but a young person who is a young woman was a teacher, not Ashley Payne, a different woman, I'm just talking about teachers today. A young woman was a teacher, and she was, a university kind of is the implication here. So she was a professor of serious literature. But what she really liked was writing fan fiction, which I have to admit, I'm not sure even exactly what fan fiction is. But I guess it's some kind of not, at least people like me, professors, think it's not serious. So some kind of fiction which is light and I guess which is about stars and things. In any case, the important point was she has this part of herself and she likes to write fan fiction. And she wanted to explore that. She wanted to exist as this kind of person, a person who is involved in fan fiction and writes about it. And maybe, who knows, maybe someday she could actually make a living out of it. I mean, I've heard of this fan fiction, so there must be a lot of it going on. And there probably is a way to monetize somehow. So maybe she was thinking, you know, maybe I will change my job from being this sober, very serious university professor of literature. And instead, write fan fiction. Maybe I will be happier that way. Maybe the kinds of people I meet will be different and I will enjoy their company more. Maybe the kind of life I lead will be different and I will enjoy living that way more. So maybe I can become a different person, which I would prefer to be. But in order to do that, again, you need to control access to your personal information. And here's a perfect case. She says, look, I don't know if I want to be a fan fiction author, but I do know that this kind of work is not taken seriously in my profession in the university, so I better hide what I'm doing from the university. So what does she do? She makes up a fake name, she puts it online, and she starts writing her fan fiction underneath a pseudonym. The history of literature is full of this. They're pseudonyms, authors using pseudonyms from the very beginning of the printing press, because they want to explore different ways of being or explore different ideas and their effects in the world without revealing that their current identity is the one who is exploring these new ideas. And then maybe, in the case of this woman, maybe she will explore under a fake name, fake avatar, for a while. And then if she has some success, then maybe at that point she can reveal the reality. And maybe that will cost her job at the university, but she doesn't care because she has this new job as a fan fiction writer. And maybe she makes more money and she enjoys it more and she's happier and so on. So she becomes a different person. But that's, again, that's only possible because in the process, she's carefully distributing or managing access to her personal information. She's carefully managing who knows what about her. She's carefully managing who knows what she, let's say the two personalities. She's one personality is carefully managing that everyone knows that she's writing literature at the university level, while the other personality is carefully managing, right, that the other fan fiction readers and such know that she's writing under a different name, this fan fiction literature. So she's kind of living a double identity, which is fine. That's part of what privacy is, right? Privacy is not just the ability to be one person. It's the ability to be two people or multiple people. I mean, in fact, that's in the Ashley Kane case, a Payne case, that's what happened, right? I mean, she was two different people. She was the teacher who would not drink and was stern and serious. And she was the woman on vacation who would drink and was fun and laughing. Those are two different people. So the idea here is that privacy allows you to be different people at the same time. And it's that process or that is that basis that allows you to become kind of with your core identity, someone else, right? You, in the case of this fan fiction writer, she is experimenting with being a different kind of writer. And if it works out well, then she can go 100% into that. But it's only because of privacy that she could experiment with that in the first place, right? That she could even begin that path of discovery. So privacy has this nice kind of double quality. Right? It's what allows us to be someone, as in the case of Ashley Payne being a teacher in the classroom, but it also allows us to be someone else, as in the case of this teacher, who is using privacy to experiment with a different kind of life, a different kind of career, and so on. So those are the two sides of privacy. And then there's a quick question here I wanted to ask. What is the ethical status of false avatars? Right, a false avatar being when you're writing under a fake name and pretending to be someone you are not. Facebook, you know, doesn't like this because you're supposed to be authentic. They say it's wrong to, kind of ethically wrong to lie about your identity. But here, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's necessarily wrong to lie about your identity. It is certain that if you are going to become someone new, you know, part of what that means, part of what is required, right, is to, in a sense, lie about your identity, right, at least in the transition process of it. So there's this, if we had more time, we could explore that. We could think, we could ask, well, what are the ethics of making a false identity online? Is that acceptable? Is that not acceptable? Why? Under what circumstances? And so on. But for right now, what we're interested in is privacy and why privacy is valuable. And what we're saying is privacy is valuable because it's what allows you to be someone, and it's what allows you to change or convert into someone else. And then a last point on that, obviously it's true practically that in order to convert into someone else, you need to experiment with that new identity. It's also just true theoretically, this is just a quick point, it's true theoretically that when you become someone new, just by definition, you have new personal identifying information since you are a new person, right? Your identifying information changes. You know? So what counts as privacy for you literally changes when you change your career, right? The information that identifies you is different. If I stop being a university professor and tomorrow and decide to become I guess I'm talking about being tall, so I will say tomorrow I decide to become a professional basketball player. Well, that changes important parts of who I am in my identity, right? What your job is defines you to a certain extent, significant extent. So when you become someone different, what counts as your personal identifying information is going to change. And then these are examples of people. Paul Bowles is someone who traveled to a new country to change. This is a woman named Connie Converse who also, she traveled to New York and became a musician at some point in her life, you know, very quickly. These are just two people, as I say, Connie Converse and Paul Bowles. You can look them up on the internet. What their lives show is how when you travel to a different place or when you adopt a new career, you literally become a different person in all kinds of different ways. In the case of Paul Bowles, it's very obvious because he traveled to and lived in North Africa. So the kinds of food he liked, the kind of religion he was exposed to, the kinds of clothes he wore, you know, the daily habits of when he would wake and sleep and eat and so on, all those things changed really radically because he went to North Africa and kind of, as we say, kind of went native, right? So the idea here is that just on the theoretical level, your personal identifying information, what it means to be you, what you eat, when you sleep, what you wear, what you enjoy, what you're afraid of, all that stuff changes when you become someone else. So privacy, again, is what allows you to be someone and is what allows you to be a different person too. Okay. And then there's a last point here. This is kind of like a little bit like the Kim Kardashian case, in the sense that it gathers up a lot of what we have said in the previous part. This is a very famous prison. It's called the Panopticon, and the idea of this prison is this was invented by a philosopher, actually, Jeremy Bentham, in England, about 100 and some years ago. And his idea was that the best way to discipline prisoners and to kind of keep order and so on is to make a circular jail. And you can see a panopticon was actually built. I believe this example is from Cuba. We don't use them anymore, but we have different ways of using them. But now we use cameras, not circles. But at the time, this is before cameras, the idea was that there would be a circular prison, and the inmates would be in each one of these cells you see along the circumference of the circle. And then the guards would be in that central tower. And the idea was of this prison, the theoretical idea of this prison was, it was kind of interesting. He said, look, the prisoners will be potentially under observation 24 hours a day by anyone. That is, any prisoner in the prison has the feeling that at any moment, at any part of the day, someone could be in the tower, because the people in the tower are kind of hidden. There's like a secret entrance from underneath or something. The people in the prison had the idea that at any moment of any day, they could be being watched by anyone. So let's say that I'm in the prison. I might think, well, right now, possibly, and one of the jail wardens is watching me. But who knows? Maybe it's my mother. Right? Maybe it's my brother. Maybe it's my children have been taken and put in this tower and they are watching me. Or maybe it's a priest. Or maybe it's a politician. Or maybe it's a policeman. Or who knows what, right? Or it's a former boss or a former girlfriend or former this or former that. Anything. Who knows? Imagine what it would be like to live in that kind of situation where you think at any moment anyone might be watching you. I think that if you had that feeling, of course, this is a theory. I don't think it really worked in practice. But in theory, right, the theory was that the prisoners would be very docile and they would, in some sense, be corrected and forced to live in ways that were civil, and they would fit in within society for when they were released, right? If they learned to live in a way in which they were being watched all the time by someone, maybe a priest, maybe a policeman, maybe their mother, who knows what. And you can kind of imagine that. I mean, if that were the case, and if you imagine that you are being watched all the time, there's a camera following you around, and you know that anyone can be looking at you at any time, I mean, imagine how that's going to change your behavior. It's going to change everything. I mean, there's so many things you're not going to do because, my God, who knows who's watching you from that camera? Now, I don't know. I don't think you would want to live that way. I know I would not want to live that way. But I'm pretty sure that someone who was living that way would be a lot less likely to commit crimes and a lot less likely to do things that were anti-civil, that would cause a problem in society. So the idea is here that to some extent, prisoners are corrected, and they're being corrected not through discipline in the sense of physical punishment, and not exactly through, and the idea here is they're not being corrected because they're being confined in the cells. Instead, they're being corrected, right? Their behaviors are being corrected and improved because they're being denied privacy. Right, they have no privacy at all, and so there's this power that privacy can have, or if you take it away, the power to control people's identity, to control who they are, what they want, how they act, what they will do in the future. That's the power of privacy, and so this is a kind of I call this an identity prison. Right, it is that in the sense it's not so much the physical body that's incarcerated, though of course that's true here too. But what's really important is that every possible kind of privacy restriction is imposed. And the true sense in which the prisoner is imprisoned is that they will not act in any way which might cause them embarrassment or shame for anybody. And then again, you just think back to the Ashley Payne case. I mean, if those are the rules, if you cannot act in a way which would ever cause you embarrassment or shame, no matter who is watching, then there's not a lot you can do. I mean, just imagine your life, right? If the only things you can do are the things you are not ashamed of, no matter who is watching, right? There are very few things you can do. You just have to be very rigid, eat normal things, go to bed at normal times, watch normal TV shows, have a normal job, wash, rinse, and repeat, right? That's it. So the power of privacy is what allows us to be someone really unique in the world, but also privacy, when it is taken away, it can be a kind of mechanism of docility. It can be a way that we force people to behave in ways that are, let's say, just not exceptional, right? In the sense of exceptional being out of the norm, that deviate in some way from what is the most typical way of living in the world. And of course, a world like that would be incredibly boring. No one wants to live in a world like that. But you can see how someone who maybe thinks a little bit too much, might think that kind of world for convicts, for people who are criminals, you know, having them learn to live in ways which are completely neutral and which are never embarrassing, you know, that might not be a bad idea, actually, right? People who are not criminals can live in more interesting and adventurous ways, but criminals who are dangerous or violent, maybe it makes sense we should try and train them to live in just very neutral ways. And maybe that makes sense. That's a different debate in justice politics and philosophy and the philosophy of penitentiaries and corrections and so on. That's a different debate, but it makes sense within the realm of privacy as an example, again, for the power that privacy presents. Privacy is what allows us to be someone. It's what allows us to be someone else. And by stripping away privacy, it can have the power of allowing us to be, in a sense, no one. No one, not because we don't exist, but no one because we don't do anything which deviates in any way from the absolute normal behavior of people. So that's the idea of the panopticon. By the way, panopticon means pan, like all seeing, all across. And opticon is like glasses, like see, so you see everything. That's the panopticon, all seeing, all is seen. And that's the idea for this prison. And we're using it to show some things about privacy. Okay. This is the last point about why we want privacy. And this is a general point about values, the values we're discussing. We've talked about autonomy. We've talked about dignity. One of the things that's characteristic of those two ways of, or those two principles, is that we want those things for themselves. They have intrinsic value, right? The idea of autonomy is something we want just because we want to be free. We don't want to be free in order to do other stuff, though we may also want to be free to do other stuff, but we do want freedom just to be free. This is kind of like the example we talked about, a very common example of this. People say, well, look, if you want freedom to be happy, why don't you just take heroin? Heroin will make you happy, but it will also make you a slave to the drug. Most people, or at least many people, say, no, I don't want that. I'd prefer to be unhappy and free than free and happy. You know, that's one reason I would not use heroin or drugs like that. So free, and then people say, and then you say, well, why do you want to be free? And people say, I just want to be free. I just want to have self-determination. I just want to make my own decisions. It's good in and of itself. I don't want it for some other reason. And then dignity is similar, right? Dignity is something that is a human value that has importance and significance just in and of itself. We want it because it's important to have intrinsically. Privacy, by contrast, it's not clear that privacy is an intrinsic value. It seems much more like it's a mediated value. That is, that we don't want necessarily privacy just in and of itself. We want privacy so that we can do other things. Privacy is as I've said about personal identity, privacy is really important. And in this way, ChatGPT was right. Privacy is really important in order for us to be free, in order for us to have autonomy, in order for us to be self-determining. Because a critical part of self-determination is deciding for myself who I am, what job I want to have, what religion I want to believe in, where I want to live. All those things, in order for me to do arrange those things in my world the way I want them, I must have and control privacy, right? For the reasons we talked about with Ashley Payne. So it seems like privacy is something we want. It's a kind of value. It's something worth having. But it seems like it's more a value or something worth having because it allows us to get other things like autonomy or like dignity or like happiness. So when people talk about privacy as a value, frequently they mean that it is a what's called a mediated value. It's a little bit like money in that way. It has value because it lets you do something else. However, that said, you can make the claim that privacy is valuable in and of itself. And some people will say, well, look, privacy is valuable in and of itself because it is kind of a form of autonomy. I mean, privacy is an aspect of autonomy or freedom itself. The two are different ways of talking about the same thing. So in that sense, it's like two sides of a coin. Like one side of the coin is autonomy and self-determination. The other side of the coin is privacy. So in that way, you could say, look, that privacy has intrinsic value in the same way that autonomy or self-determination does. And other people say, it's even beyond that. Even if privacy is different from autonomy, it still has, there's still a sense in which it has value. And maybe it's hard to define exactly what that value is, but we feel it in our bodies and in our sensations. And then there, the example would be something like the surveillance cameraman. When someone sits down in front of you and starts taking video, you do get kind of a creepy feeling. It's hard to define exactly what that feeling is or why you have it. But it's pretty clear that it's bad. You don't like it when someone just sits down in front of you and starts filming you. So maybe we can't define exactly why privacy is intrinsically valuable. Maybe we can't exactly articulate what it is about privacy that makes it something that's worth having just in and of itself. But it still may be that way. So on the question of privacy and why we want it, what I'm wanting to conclude here is that there are two very, very big ways. One could be that it has an intrinsic value. We just want it because we want it. And the other, and we've spent most of our time talking about this, we've said it is a mediated value. We want it because it allows us to be someone and to be someone else. It allows us to be who we are and to change into a different kind of person and live in a different kind of way. Okay, so let's see. I guess I should throw this in just very quickly. As a footnote, I mean, almost this entire section has been devoted to why we want privacy and why it's good. But it is worth noting, and there are a lot of reasons to not want privacy. And one of the reasons right here is the story of this woman. She was wearing an Apple Watch. And, you know, these watches, they keep track of your, or at least approximate your heartbeat and the steps you've taken and other kinds of things. So in the case of this woman, the Apple Watch actually did detect, this is a true story, and there are multiple versions of this story. The Apple Watch did detect an irregularity in her heartbeat, which she did not detect herself. I mean, maybe she was a little bit tired or something, but she did not feel like anything was wrong. But her watch told her that something was wrong and sent her an alert. And because of that, she went to the hospital and maybe her life was saved. Now, Difficult case, because when you buy the Apple Watch and set it up, it's not clear to whom you are giving consent about your heartbeat. But just for the sake of a thought experiment, let's just pretend that she put that watch on and just put it on and didn't consent to anything, but Apple still linked up to her watch without her consent. So that's a privacy violation for sure. Apple linked up to her watch without her consent, got her heartbeat, but saved her life, right? So it is possible, and it is more than theoretical. I mean, certainly if it has not happened yet, it will happen, that someone's life will be saved because their privacy is violated. And it seems like with AI healthcare and things like smartwatches and surveillance everywhere, that will happen increasingly, that when our privacy is violated, we get real benefits. Another example of this, of course, is if you're saved from a terrorist attack because surveillance cameras pick up that this person is a terrorist, and so the police can come in and stop this person, well, it saves the lives of all the innocent victims. That's just another example of how privacy violations would save a life, or save lives. So it's not like, right? It's not like we exist in a vacuum where everyone just wants privacy all the time. And there are real good arguments against privacy. And there are real reasons for why people would not want privacy, at least in certain contexts, one where it might save your life. Now, of course, the difficulty is it's hard to know beforehand when privacy violations might save your life or might not. In the case of the watch, you have no idea if you're going to have a regular heartbeat, which is dangerous, or not. You have no idea when that might occur. So it's not certain if you should sign up or if you should allow privacy violations all the time for everything in order to save your life. Well, if it's to save your life, then yeah, it's probably worth it, right? Because if you're not alive, privacy doesn't matter too much anyway. But it's not clear where we would want to draw the line. Once we start opening the debate about when privacy violations should be allowed, it's not clear where we should draw the line about up to what point. I mean, how many lives need to be saved? If we're going to live in a surveillance society, how many lives need to be saved in order for us to justify and say, yeah, you know what? It's okay for us to be monitored all the time, even if we don't like it or don't know it. That's a whole another debate. Now, in this seminar, what we're trying to do is understand what privacy is and why it's valuable. And so we've mainly concentrated on the question about what our privacy preservation. But you can just see from this one example that there's a whole bunch of other debates you could have where you would say, look, we don't want privacy at all, and we should get rid of it in order to have something else. We're going to return to this a little bit at the end when we talk about utilitarianism. But I just wanted to also slide that in here, the idea that privacy is something we want intrinsically, but that doesn't mean that it's something we want at the cost of everything else. It's perfectly reasonable to say that in some circumstances we don't want privacy. And maybe in the case of the watch, say, saving your life, maybe we say to Apple, the company, Apple Watch Company, instead of becoming angry that they're taking away my personal information about my heartbeat without my consent, maybe we say, look, thank you, because you saved my life. So it is an open debate, an open question. So those are the main ideas about privacy and why we want it and what it is good for. And so we can take 5 minutes to think about that. Okay, so next we're going to talk about a specific case. We've been talking about Facebook a little bit, kind of in the background of what we've been saying, but now we will talk about it more specifically. And we're going to talk about a very specific aspect of Facebook and its mission. Now, this is Mark Zuckerberg, recognizably Mark Zuckerberg. He is the founder and CEO, or was, I guess I'm not sure if he is anymore, but certainly he was the founder and main owner of Facebook. And so he sets the tone for what the company does. And he says, this is a very sort of famous quote from him from, what is it? That's now 14 years ago. But I don't think Facebook has changed since then. He says, you have one identity. The days of having a different image for your coworkers and for other people you know are coming to an end. Having two identities for yourself is a lack of integrity. Okay, this is very important because this idea is at the core of what Facebook as a company believes and what the culture perpetuates insofar as this active online and on the web and so on. So I want to look at this statement really carefully, and I want to talk about it in three terms. I want to talk about empirically, as what's actually happening in the world, psychologically, what it means for people, and then ethically, whether or not we want this to happen or not. Just in general, I mean, that sounds good, right? You have one identity, and the days of you having a different image for your coworkers and for other people you know are coming to an end. Having two identities for yourself is a lack of integrity. It sounds very lofty and honorable and noble. It sounds good. I'm not so sure. Maybe it is. Let's see. The first thing, empirically, is it actually happening in the world that the days of you having a different image for your coworkers and for other people you know are coming to an end? I mean, is that a true statement? It seems to me that that is a true statement, at least to a certain extent. Certainly, it is a true statement insofar as Facebook is involved, right? Because one of the things that Facebook does is it gathers up information from how you live with your family, like you post pictures of your family, and puts it right alongside information about your professional life. Facebook is filled up with pictures and scenes from people at work and so on. And it fills it up with scene with your life of your friends, right? So let's say, let's just to make things simple, let's say there's three spheres of your life. You have your family life and husbands and wives. You have your work life, bosses and employees. And you have, let's just say a friend life, you know, where you're just hanging out with friends, having tea or beers or something, what have you. Of course, that's a simplification, but let's just imagine that there are those three parts of our lives. And one thing that Facebook does very industriously is that it does gather on your timeline all those three parts of your life so that people can see it in one swoop, these three different ways that you are. And that makes a difference, right? It makes it much harder for individuals, at least who are involved in working on Facebook, it makes it much harder for people to maintain sort of one identity and one way of being when they are at work, and another identity and another way of being when they are at home, and another identity and another way of being when they are with their friends. It's kind of like the Ashley Payne thing, right? What she wanted to maintain was this difference between how she was with her friends, double fisting, drinking, and how she was at work, like a stern, serious teacher. But what Facebook did, by jamming everything that goes on in your life into one wall and one set of posts and one set of pictures that are constantly being tagged and leading to other pictures of you, is that it just made it impossible for her to keep Ashley Payne could not keep those things apart. And what happened to her is happening to everybody on Facebook. The different sides of our lives are swinging together. So, I mean, if you are watching this video, you know me only, at least directly, only as a professor. So I dress in a certain way. I speak in a certain tone. I drink certain things. I'm drinking coffee. I'm not drinking beers and so on. As far as you know, just joking. Right. So I act in a certain way and do certain things. But it probably wouldn't be too hard for you. If you wanted, you could Google me and you would be able to find stuff about other parts of my life too. What Facebook does is it takes away the need to Google. It just smashes everything that exists in your life, your work life, personal life, and so on, slams it all together in one feed and one web of being tagged and so on. And what Zuckerberg wants to say, and what Facebook as a culture wants to say is that's part of the intention of the platform. That's why the platform is there. I call it 360-degree exposure, or it's something like the panopticon reality, right? So when you have everyone knows this, that when you have your Facebook wall, that wall could be seen by your parents, by your friends, by your children, by husbands and wives, so you want to be sort of careful about what you put on your wall. But more and more, and again, the Ashley Payne case is really a good case. More and more people just say, forget it. I'm just going to put everything up there, right? Like I say, it was only I can't remember how many years it was, 20 years ago. It was only 20 years ago that putting drinking on your wall, where you also had professional things, that was so scandalous and so crazy that someone lost her job. And that's not true anymore. Now people just smash everything on there together, right? They put images of them drinking and then images of them working, and no one gets fired for that anymore. So you can see that the Facebook culture, it's happening. It's real. It's true, right? This ability we once had to keep different parts of our identity separate, right? To keep our drinking and fun life separate from our professional life, and that's collapsing. And you can see it collapsing in real time. Now everyone knows everything about us. Now, is that literally true? Of course not. But empirically, that's the direction things are going. And you can see that specifically by just looking at what's happening on Facebook. So again, returning to the original quote, Zuckerberg is saying, the days of you having a different image, like a different personality, a different self, for your co-workers, and let's say for your friends, are coming to an end. He's right. That's true. I'm not sure it will end, right? I'm not sure how long it will take to end, but it is coming. It is moving in that direction. That's true. And then so we can move that. If that's the empirical case, then what is the psychological case? Well, the psychological case is that multiple identity is diminishing. That is, your ability to be different person with your friends and at work, and that ability is disappearing. We're less able to do that, and we have less freedom to do that. Our privacy, the control we have over our personal information, is being squeezed by this Facebook platform. I mean, it's really, really difficult now for us to control who knows about the way we act when we're on vacation. It used to be really easy. The only people who knew about the way we acted on vacation were people who were on vacation with us. Now it's slipping and sliding because we put stuff onto the Facebook wall and then someone else puts a picture too and tags us. Now it just slips and slides into everyone knowing. And the same thing with our professional life, right? More and more people now know more and more about what I am like as a professor. Videos like this are circulating on the web. It's really hard for me to control or to limit access to how I am as a professor. And this is true for almost everyone in almost every job because we're just focusing on Facebook for a moment, because of Facebook, right? This idea that we can have multiple identities at the same time. That's what I mean when I say vertically. The fact that today, on this one day of the week, I can be the sober, serious professor, and then as soon as this video turns off, I can go slam 6 shots of vodka, and then I can go try to play basketball. So I can be both a serious professor and a crazy drinker and an endeavoring basketball player. I can be all those 3 different people on one day, right? In essence, at the same time, right? So when I say that multiple identity is diminishing vertically, I mean it's harder and harder to keep those 3 different parts of my identity. And I really don't slam 7 hits of vodka, and I really don't play basketball, but just pretend, right? It's getting more and more difficult for me to keep those different ways of being, those different parts of my identity. It's becoming more and more difficult to keep them apart, to keep them separate, to keep them as different people. Why? Because everyone has access to the wall and sees that there he is teaching, there he is drinking, there he is playing basketball. So that's the horizontal problem with identity. Well, it's not a problem. It's a reality, right? He says it's good. But we're going to come to that. And then there's also the idea, the horizontal version. It's also true. This is happening much more slowly, of course. But for people born today, who have their baby pictures posted on Facebook and so on, their entire lives will be forever visible somewhere online. I mean, that's not true for someone in my generation. There's almost kind of a cutoff point where there is almost no information about me. Let's say, just choose a point. Let's say, from the point I graduated graduate school, more or less. If you look before, try and find out information about me before I got my graduate degree, before I finished studying philosophy in graduate school. If you try to find out information about me, it would be really hard. I mean, you would find some paper documents, you know, some grades and things. You would find some pictures in a high school yearbook, a college yearbook. You would find some pictures in an attic somewhere. But it would be really difficult for you to get a sense of what happened in my life before I got my graduate degree. And those things really only kind of exist here. And decreasingly, our brains have limited memory space, so it becomes harder to remember things. And there is a lot of my life which is completely dark, in which will never be recovered, even by me. I don't remember exactly which summer job I had, what summer. I don't think there's any way to recover that. I can find maybe a picture at home in the attic of me wearing the clothes that I would wear when one summer I worked as a waiter in a restaurant. I remember doing that. But I'm not sure that I would be able to recover what year exactly that was. I'm not sure. Maybe if you offered me $1 million, I would find some way, but maybe not. So there is, for my life, there is kind of a line, pre-web line, where there is a lot of darkness, where it's, I don't know what happened. But that's not true for people who are born today. For people who are born today, almost everything is going to be recorded forever, right? Their whole life is going to be on a timeline of pictures and text messages, text and video and voice messages and so on. If you collect all of that, you will have if you collected all of it, I mean, you would have a really complete picture of the life of someone, right, who was born today. So there's this idea that that who you are is, let me put it one different way. It's not just that what I was in the past is black, it's unknown. It's also that, again, I'm just going to make this up. Let's imagine that in my past, I was an axe murderer, right? I would wander around and with my axe and do bad things to innocent people. And then I was caught and sent to jail, but I was a juvenile, so it let me out. And since then, I have not been doing any axe murdering, so don't worry about it. But that record of, let's just say that I was an axe murderer when I was 16. I had a bad 16 year. That record of that existence is virtually, again, I'm just making this up, obviously, is virtually non-existent. And there's no pictures, or maybe one or two pictures, but they're hidden in an attic somewhere. That whole part of my identity is completely gone, right? Is buried in the past, has nothing to do with me now. And if let's just say that for some reason I Tomorrow, let's just imagine I'm unmarried, but I meet the love of my life tomorrow and I share everything with her. I could do that without ever revealing that I was this, again, this is a bad example, but I'm stuck in it, so I've got to keep going. Without ever having to share it with her that I was once an axe murderer, right? And there's no record of it. I was a juvenile. Record was sealed and it's gone. But that's not true anymore for people who are young today. They will never be able to escape their past. They will never be able to completely separate themselves from the identity that they were at 16 or 6 or 36 or what have you. So what I'm saying here is that psychologically, what Zuckerberg is saying, that's also true. People's ability to be different people is diminishing, and it's diminishing both vertically and horizontally. I can really only be one person today, no matter how different my acts are, because everyone can see everything. And I can be only one person through time because everything is visible. It can all be incorporated into one identity. So now you know that I have I have anger issues since I'm an axe murderer. Okay, so that's the empirical, the psychological aspect of what Zuckerberg is saying. And I think that, there's just some things that we can imagine in kind of a pure Facebook society. I mean, what will it be like when Facebook gets what they want? What will it be like when all of our life is there on our wall for everybody to see? It seems like, I'm not sure, the question I'm asking is, would you want to live this way? We may not have a choice. The one thing is, I mean, if we know everything about everyone, then it might be sort of the end of shame, since everyone has their things that they do that are shameful, that they don't want to admit to other people, like the one I'm making up as you sing ABBA songs in the shower, right? Well, if everyone has everything revealed, then I guess none of us will be ashamed anymore, since all of us can see everything about everyone else, everything embarrassing we do. So, I mean, maybe in that way it's good, right? We no longer need to be embarrassed of anything, since everyone sees everything. But I'm not sure if it's good. I'm just posing that question. And then there's another question too, we're headed toward the ethical response to this Facebook reality of just having one identity, just one. And there's this question of authenticity. If you know everything about me, if you know my entire life, and what I do when I'm having fun with my friends, what I do with my family, what I did when I was a waiter when I was 16, etc., you know everything, that whole set of things. There's this question, do you know the true me? Is the true who I am just that kind of like the summary of data of everything that I have done up to now? Is that my authentic self? If you have pictures and video and text and everything of every moment of my life and you synthesize all that, maybe you couldn't do that personally, but like artificial intelligence could do that. Could the machine know who I am authentically? Or is it that there's who I am, and then there's the set of all the various me's in time, and that set is different from who I am? An example of this, I have the case of the Theseus ship. The reference here is, just imagine that you have a wooden ship, and you have every piece of wood, and the ship is only made of wood. So we don't need nails on this ship. It somehow all holds together. The ship is only made of wood, and you have all the pieces of wood laid out on the ground. And then you take all those pieces of wood and you put them together and to form a boat and push that boat out into the water and it floats and everything is great. Is that boat just the same thing as the sum of all the pieces of wood? Or is all the pieces of wood one thing and the boat something else? I think that's very similar to the question I'm asking here about authenticity and personal identity. If you know everything about me, my entire past and everything, and you put it all together, what you're looking at now, is that the me which is everything all put together? Or is that something else? Right? There's kind of the me that is here now, and then there's this other me, which is everything all put together. Kind of like there's all the wood that's on the dock, and then there's all the wood which is put together as a boat floating away. It seems to me that the boat is different than the pieces. That seems to me to be the case. But I'm not sure if it's that way for humans or not. We're getting now kind of deeply, and I won't take us any deeper into this, but we're getting kind of deeply into some philosophical questions about personal identity and who we authentically are. And these questions are going to be forced to the surface with greater and greater insistence as data gathering of the kind that Facebook does increases its penetration into our lives. Or that is, as privacy recedes and Facebook gets more and more of our personal information, we're going to be asking more frequently these kinds of questions about who we truly are, which self corresponds with the way we live now. And then the last point I sometimes make is that if you know your true and complete self, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Do you really want to know who you are? I'm not sure we do. Maybe the unknown, not knowing who we are, gives us a kind of liberty or freedom to, it's what allows us to make ourselves in different ways. It kind of keeps us going. If I knew everything about myself, if like the computer took all my personal information and formed this final image and said, Brousseau, this is your true self. This is what you really like to wear. This is what you really like to eat. This is when you really like to sleep. This is the perfect job for you. This is the perfect partner for you. This is the perfect place to live for you. If you got all that stuff, I'm not sure I would want to know that. And maybe it might be kind of frightening if I found out the stuff I really like. Maybe I wouldn't like the person who likes that stuff. Maybe. There's a lot of questions there. But to come to the point for Facebook, what Zuckerberg is saying and what Facebook as a culture believes is that you must be who you are. That's the idea of their account integrity. That's their idea of authentic identity. That's why Facebook says that you can't have a false avatar or a false person online. We've seen in the case, remember the case of the person who was experimenting with being a fan fiction writer. I mean, we saw in that case that they wanted to make a fake identity online. And I think that most people in most situations would not object to that ethically. I think that most people would say, well, you know, that's okay. It's true that it's a lie. It's true that it's dishonest. But it's not clear that it's hurting anyone. And further, it is a way that you express your freedom to experiment with new ways of living in the world and new ways of being someone. So it seems like you can defend the practice, at least in some situations, of having a fake identity online. But Facebook says no. And Facebook's entire quote from Zuckerberg, right? Having two identities for yourself is a lack of integrity, right? That's an ethical claim. It's also a literal claim. Like integrity means to be held together. A lack of integrity means you're falling apart. So it's a good quote, smart quote. Having two identities for yourself is literally a lack of integrity. It's literally falling apart. But the ethics idea is that it's bad, right? That's what he's saying. He's saying that ethically, it is bad. It's not desirable, and it is objectionable to have two identities for yourself. That's what he's saying. And then that's what Facebook as a culture is saying. It's saying that because you must be authentic on the platform. authentic means two things. You have to use your true name and so on. And two, right, you have to participate in this centrifugal force that swings together your professional life, your work life, your personal, your friend's life, your romantic life, all that stuff, brings it all together and puts it on that one wall. It joins it together. It makes you one person, right? It's not like the Ashley Payne who's a partier double fisting and the Ashley Payne who's the earnest teacher. Now it's all just one person. Facebook does that. It's dedicated to doing that to you and to me. That's what Facebook understands by integrity. That's what Facebook does with their rules. And the ethical claim, remember I said we're doing the empirical, the psychological, we're on the ethical claim is that's good. Facebook is saying that's the way things should be. You must be who you are. I'm not so sure, but it's an interesting argument. It's an interesting argument. In any case, what is certain is that with respect to privacy, because that's what we're talking about now, not Facebook, with respect to privacy, the Facebook mission is a disaster, right? Facebook is essentially saying we should want the end of privacy, and that's good. I'm not sure. If we had more time, I say that frequently because there's so many different directions that we could go in. We would talk about authenticity and multiplicity, the idea that you either have one identity, which is who you are, or you can have multiple identities and never be any one true person. This is an important and significant debate in the history of philosophy. The single man here, appropriately enough, this is Martin Heidegger. He is an advocate of authenticity, of the idea that you are someone and you want to be that one person. Something like the project of Facebook. Heidegger would not like that I'm saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway, because it's okay in AI ethics. The project of Facebook corresponds with Heidegger, with the idea that you are one person, one authentic person, and we will find out who that person is, and we will force you to be that person. That's Heidegger. On the other side, there's the double side, the two, which could be more. That's Gilles Deleuze. He's an advocate of the other idea. He's an advocate of the idea that authenticity is bad. That's not quite right. Authenticity is not desirable in and of itself. Instead, having multiple identities, that's desirable. That's what we want. That's what we should seek. You will have to decide for yourself. I don't know. But it's Heidegger versus Deleuze. Heidegger is the Facebook and Deleuze is the anti-Facebook in the history of philosophy. Okay. So why don't we just take a few minutes now to think about this idea of authenticity and being one person and the eradication of privacy and the raising up of integrity, personal integrity, in the sense that you are one person, the elevating of integrity, what you think about that, and what it all means for privacy. In other words, are you for or against this Facebook authenticity, and what does that mean for privacy? And then we can go on, and there are just two sections left. The last one is going to be very quick, but this one here, protecting privacy today, we'll take just a little bit of time on that to think about some of the, just in technical terms, some of the ways that privacy is being protected, there is discussion about protecting privacy in the area of information technology. And there are two basic strategies for protecting user privacy, again, in information technology. One is privacy by design, that is developing information technology systems and processes and data collection and all that stuff, everything about AI and computing and computer science, all that stuff, develop in a way which helps preserve privacy. That's one path we'll look at. The other path we'll look at is an idea that we could consider our personal information as something that we own that has value, like our labor in some sense. And it's something we can buy and sell. So that's a different strategy. We'll come to that in a second. But first, let's think just quickly about privacy by design. I don't think we need to look at ChatGPT for this. Privacy by design means simply that when we design artificial intelligence systems, broadly, when we design the data intake and what data is necessary and how that data is used for what purposes and so on, the entire pipeline of work from conception of the idea to when we terminate the whole program, that entire pipeline of work includes thought about maximizing the protection of users' privacy. And typically, this kind of conception of the pipeline, this kind of conception of design, includes data minimization, which means we protect privacy by taking or asking for only the minimum amount of data which is required to do a task, using that data only to do the task at hand, and then deleting the data when the task is terminated. So let's take an example of AI healthcare. Let's say you want to check, we've talked about the EKG of the heart. Let's say you want to check my heart using artificial intelligence. So what would you do if you're a doctor? Well, you would want to take the EKG, write the line, get that information. That's the data. But you would take only that information, the chunk. You would not take other information like my weight or my height and that kind of stuff. Data minimization means you take only the information which is absolutely required to do the specific task that you want to do. So you don't ask for stuff like what other medications you're taking or when you last ate or that kind of stuff. You just get the heartbeat. That's the start. And then the second part of data minimization is, okay, once you've got that data about my heart, then you only use it to diagnose how well my heart is doing or not doing. You don't then sell that data to other companies to use it for some other purpose. So you take the minimum, you use it only for the one purpose that you originally acquired it, which is to study my heart. And then finally, the last part of data minimization is that once you're finished, once you've determined that my heart is good or bad, then you destroy the data so that it can't be used elsewhere. So if you conceive a process that way, so if you make an AI pipeline that requests only the necessary information that ensures that it's used only at the place or only within the project of its initial acquisition, and it's automatically destroyed upon termination of the project, right? Then you've gone a long way toward protecting user privacy. A lot of what happens in the world, and this is what happened again, it's Ashley Payne again. The reason people lose privacy or the reason things go wrong in the area of privacy is because information that they wanted to have in one area, like her party information, somehow slipped out, leaked out into another area, in this case, her professional life. So data minimization tries to block that kind of leakage by only getting the minimum data, using it in a very narrow way, and then deleting. So that's one privacy by design strategy, and it does help. Clearly, it will help to ensure that privacy is maintained by users or for users. Another strategy is called differential privacy. We're not going to go deeply into this. This is a statistical technique which is used to when you take someone's information, like their heartbeat, you can make certain adjustments to the surrounding information, like the name. And let's say that you do want to gather things like weight and height, because that does affect heart health, and it probably does. So you probably do want to gather those other things. But there are some statistical ways that once you have that data, that you can confuse a little bit the way the data fits together and how it might attach to one or another specific person. You do it by changing things randomly, but within certain limited parameters. Again, we're not going to go into that here. You can just Google it. It's interesting. It involves sort of coin flips and such at certain points. But the point of it is that the technology allows you to use personal information for things like healthcare and other purposes without, at least hopefully, without revealing to whom that information belongs. So you can have the information and use it without breaching privacy. That's the idea. Now, in the real world, does that actually happen? In the real world, it's really hard. In order for data to be useful, you have to know a lot about the person who has it, at least in healthcare. You've got to know kind of the age and the height and the weight and all that stuff. If you've got all that stuff, it's pretty easy to connect it to a certain person. So it's really hard to make little statistical changes that are sufficient to block access to the identity, but also not so much that they make the data worthless in the actual world. But you can try. And trying to do that is differential privacy. And then a third kind of strategy for maintaining privacy is obfuscation. That's the title of this book here. That's very clever. What you do with obfuscation is instead of trying, you maintain privacy not by keeping information inside you, not by restricting the release of information, not by having very little information. Instead, you do the opposite. Obfuscation is you maintain privacy by having too much information, by putting ever more information out, presumably about you. And so one example of this, there is an add-on, I think, to Firefox and maybe to other browsers. What it does is in the background while you're browsing, this add-on also visits just random websites. So that the companies that are watching you as you browse, like Verizon and AT&T and so on, they're all watching where you're going. They're getting in their feed, they're getting the true sites that you visit. Like, let's say I'm visiting a site that talks about, we're talking about heart health. So I'm visiting a site that talks about heart health, and that might reveal that, yes, I'm worried about my heart, but it does not reveal that if at the same time, you know, this app that I have running in the background is also visiting a web page which has to do with lung health and which has to do with lifeguards and which has to do with coffee cups and which has to do with computers. And so you just get so much, so many web visits that the data is worthless. It doesn't tell you anything. That's obfuscation. It's when you keep information personal, not by hiding the information, but by embedding it in a giant tidal wave of other wrong information so much into the degree that it's impossible to find within this blizzard of facts, right? Within this blizzard of websites that I'm visiting, it's impossible to figure out which ones actually respond to me in my personal life and my personal problems and interests and so on. So obfuscation is the idea that you maintain privacy not by limiting information and having less, but by maximizing information and having always more, so much so that the information is worthless. That's a clever idea. And the book is clever. It has some good examples. So that's one idea. The idea that you can have privacy by design, that is, when you're designing or imagining the AI system, you try to do it in a way which maximizes user privacy. Another idea, a distinct idea, is the idea that we can let individuals monetize their personal information. So that's kind of what I have in this graphic here from the opt-out button. We could make tools so that I could say, for example, to Netflix, okay, you can know about the movies that I like to watch, but you have to give me $1 a week or something for this information. That's basically what happened in the case where I talked about the TV and the camera. Basically, what the people do who take that deal is They sell their personal information. They say, okay, I will give up my control over access to this information. I'll let you see everything I'm doing in my living room. But I'm going to sell you that right, and the price is a free TV. So that's a different kind of strategy now, right? Instead of trying to maintain privacy by protecting our personal information, now we're saying we're going to emphasize the idea that Kim Kardashian is also private. We're going to emphasize the idea that privacy is about consent. It's about my control over my information. And we're going to say, what we want to do is let me sell my personal data, how tall I am, how much I weigh, and what my interests are, what I eat, what I watch, when I do things, who I do them with, all that stuff. I have privacy insofar as I have control over that information, and I have control over that information insofar as I am exchanging it in an economic market, right? I'm either receiving money from someone because I'm giving them this information, or I'm getting a free TV. So that's a different way of maintaining privacy. It maintains privacy instead of making the information scarce or making it hard to get information about me. It just emphasizes or focuses on the fact that I am in control over the information that circulates about me. And I am in control in the way, in basically an economic way, that in one sense or another, I buy and sell the access to my information. And then a very quick point to make here, I talk about the Lockean model or intellectual creative property. If we are going to say that I own my own information, or do I own it in the same way that I own like this pen? Or do I own it in a different sense? In Europe and in the United States, artists, to a lesser degree here, but strongly in Europe, artists are considered owners of their work. Even after they sell that work, they are considered owners in a limited sense. That is, if I buy an artist's work in Europe, I can hang that, it's a painting, I can hang that painting wherever I like, because I own it. But what I cannot do is I cannot destroy that painting, because that somehow kind of the right of authorship or the fact of authorship, that is inalienable and it belongs to the artist even when he or she sells the actual canvas. So there's this idea that there are some things that someone makes, like a creative act, that they maintain even when they maintain some ownership of it, even when they sell it. And so you could say maybe data is like that. I mean, maybe data is something I sell like a pen, and once I sell it, that's it. I have no more claims. Or maybe data, my personal information, is something more like art, and I can sell it to be used by someone, but there are just intrinsic limits to how and to what degree it can be used. Just like, as I say, if you buy a painting, that does not give you the right to destroy the painting, only to hang the painting wherever you want. That's also another one of those discussions that could go on for weeks and hours, weeks and years, I mean. And then another quick point, individuals versus society as owners of personal information. Yet another discussion that could go on for hours. To what extent does the public have a legitimate right to claiming ownership of your personal information? This question arose very palpably in the case of COVID, when some governments in New Zealand especially made the claim that they, as a public entity, have the right to know whether or not you are sick and where you go. And where you go because you might be sick. And so this is the famous New Zealand Tracer app, where in New Zealand, wherever you went outside during COVID, you had to check in there. So the government knew where everyone was. And the claim, that was made there was that at least during COVID, this information about your location, which is very personal information, where are you and when, you know, if you're at the grocery market, it's one thing. You can think of some other places at certain times you might want people not to know you're there, but you have to reveal everything. Where you are and when, the government said, look, this personal information now belongs to the government, and it belongs to the government. We own it because of this public health emergency. Now, again, here, because of artificial intelligence and information technology, the temptation that governments are going to have to make this claim is only going to grow, because we started to see it in COVID, but we will see it increasingly in all kinds of other areas. The things that governments can do for our welfare, and that's probably the intention, of course, but we'll see how it works out. The things that governments can do to help us are going to increase very rapidly as they have access to our personal information. Where we are, when, are we sick, are we not sick, and so on. So as that happens, we expect that we will see more conflicts about privacy in the space between me as an individual and society generally, as represented by the government. Who owns my data legitimately in extreme cases like COVID? Do I still own my data? Or in extreme cases, does the government then own my data? And then is there kind of a creep? First, it's just COVID. Then it's just COVID and, then it's just COVID and, right? On and on. That's something we will see as time goes on. Okay, so that's very quickly, that's the conclusion of that section. What we wanted to do there is say, what's going on in the world about this privacy stuff? What's actually happening? And there are two things that are happening. Both occur in the area of trying to protect user privacy. And one, as I say, is this the increasing, increasingly important field of privacy by design. If you're working in computer science, that's almost certainly a field of growth in the future. How we can design AI systems to work effectively to accomplish their goals while also minimizing the personally identifiable information that is used, and minimizing access or the possibility of leakages of that information. And there's just a self-interested reason there by companies, right? This happens all the time that now that banks and credit card companies, they lose to hackers and such. They lose the personal information, and then they have to pay lawsuits and do all kinds of changes because this information has been breached. So companies have a real deep financial interest in maintaining some protection, some privacy for their users. And insofar as technology can help them do that, you know, companies will be very interested in that. So that's a good field for people who are in computer science to explore professionally. So that was one side. And then there's this more intellectual debate about ownership of my personal information. To what degree do I own it? And how can things be arranged so that I can, in a sense, buy and sell my information on the open market, just like you can do when you trade privacy for a free TV set. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of economic exchange there. And again, most importantly, this really emphasizes the idea of privacy as control over access. And I control it with economic tools. So that's protecting privacy today. And now we're on to the very last. I think it's the very last, yes. There's two more things. The very last slide is just very quickly. We've been talking about explore exploit. We talked about that in the autonomy section. And I think it's pretty clear that you can imagine how explore exploit, that divergence, connects up with privacy and personal freedom and self-determination. To the degree which privacy is maximized and to the degree which autonomy and freedom is maximized, then that's, you're kind of in the explore area as opposed to exploit. You're in explore because you know very little about the person. So you're going to spend all your energy, if you're doing predictive analytics, you're going to spend all your energy trying to find out what kinds of interests someone has when they're maintaining very tight control over their personal information and when they're maximizing autonomy. Because as I say, as we've seen today, maximizing autonomy implies kind of shifting your personal information, changing what the things that define who you are. And so that corresponds naturally with the need for those who are interested in predictive analytics to explore who people are. Whereas by contrast, authenticity, the idea that the Facebook kind of idea, that we collapse the barriers to privacy, that we strip away control and force people who are participating on our platform to bring together all these different sides of their identity and reveal who they are personally, professionally, socially, with friends, family, and so on, reveal those things and bring those things together. There is the justification for that is this idea of authenticity, this idea of integrity, this idea that we are one person and we should be that one person. That tilts strongly toward the notion of exploit. I mean, if we are just one person and we know who that person is, then it seems like it's a very short step to getting us the right job, the right entertainment, the right spouse, the right geographical location, the right clothes, everything. This goes all the way back to those very first dilemmas we had in the autonomy section. And if you could get the perfect job, but you couldn't try anything else, would you want that? Well, privacy and the Facebook insistence on authenticity is putting that into practice. And there are advantages and disadvantages. On the one side, authenticity does seem good. It's good to be who you are. People always say, well, I'm going to take the summer off and go find myself. Well, this idea that you're going to find yourself, find out who you are, is the idea or posits as a premise the idea that you are someone. There is someone you can find, right? You can't find yourself if there's not someone you can find. So if you're looking for yourself, that implies there's this one true self that you are. And Facebook exists. Facebook says, we are here to help you be that one person. And that's very positive. That leads then on this chart to exploit. But on the other side, that also, as we see in the explore area, that also means that your freedom is being radically limited. Your autonomy is being significantly constrained, and your privacy is being rendered irrelevant. So you're kind of choosing between those two things. Maximum privacy, maximum autonomy, maximum self-determination, maximum freedom, explore, or maximum authenticity, but minimal freedom, minimal privacy, and exploit, which is good. It's not exploit in this sense, it's exploit in the good sense, that since we know who we are, we have an authentic identity, we can give you the right job, we can give you the right spouse, we can give you the right clothes, all those things. So at the end here, what privacy really allows us to do is bring together the idea of autonomy. And also there's something about dignity here too. But the question is, what is more dignified? Is it more dignified to be free, or is it more dignified to be authentic? That's a hard question. And privacy is right there, right in between them. If we're going to maximize privacy, and we're going to allow people to maintain control of their personal information, then that's going to define dignity as autonomy, as freedom. By contrast, if we're going to minimize privacy and say that we're going to swing together and meld together all the aspects of our lives as Facebook promotes, then we're going to, as I say, minimize privacy, but we are going to associate human dignity with the idea of authenticity, with the idea of being who we are. So that's the choice. Do you want to be free, or do you want to be who you are? One or the other. And privacy is about making that decision. Okay? So that's what I'm trying to say here. That's the end of discussion about privacy for the lecture. But please go to this. This is very quick. Please go to this website and take the poll in just 5 minutes. It is asking you to do to talk about privacy in kind of a cultural way, and we will talk about that subsequently. So just take 5 minutes and do that poll. Okay, so that's the idea of what privacy is. Privacy is control over access to your personal information. The important ideas are control. You decide what people know about you, and personal information. It's not sure what personal information is exactly. And then we said privacy is, in a sense, what swings or makes a decision between having maximum freedom or maximum authenticity. And we said that dignity could be associated with either one or the other. But I don't think both. Okay, that's enough for today.